Ask Dr. Dawn is produced by Jiva Media at the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn, KUSP's own interactive health question and answer, debate, dialogue, and discussion of health in the news. I hope you'll stay tuned for an hour of, well, hopefully my opinions and yours, and in a few moments I'll be giving out the numbers, but before I do that, those opinions I just referred to, well, those opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the opinions of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment, maybe even to get you excited about science, but it is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. That being said, I want to welcome all of you and give out the phone numbers. We'll be taking your calls in just a few moments at 476-2800, 1-800-655-5877. Last week, we had a caller who wanted to know about a new side effect that she had read about of the drug Fosamax. Actually, this side effect turns out to be probably a class effect for all of the bisphosphonates, but she'd only heard about it with respect to Fosamax, so she didn't know that. But doing a little investigating, that was the first fact I came upon. So it sounds like the typical overblown everybody's going to die kind of hype. So let me give you the straight shot here. The class of drugs, bisphosphonates, are working for osteoporosis by causing a change in the structure of the bone. It makes it harder for the bone breakdown cells to break down bone. So it slows down the osteoclasts. Having done that, bone does not, the balance of bone break down to build up, which becomes disrupted after menopause in women. In women, I should say, who have the right DNA for that particular disruption. Well, that condition, osteoporosis, is very common in older women in our society. Not all that uncommon in men, although we don't check them as often as we should. And this drug, among other bisphosphonates, have become one of the mainstays in therapy. We can see increases in bone density, which is nice, but more importantly, we can see reductions in fracture risk that start pretty early. This is a teeter-totter sort of effect, and by loading one side of the teeter-totter, we make those bones stronger and less likely to fracture. Well, what happens when you slow down bone breakdown? Conceivably, if that bone is damaged already, you might slow down bone healing, and in fact, that seems to be the case with the osteonecrosis of the jaw. What it really comes out to is this. Most people who have had this condition, which is a loss of bone in the jaw, the bone actually erodes away and it doesn't grow back, or it's hard to get it to grow back. Almost all of the people who have had this have been people with cancer, usually breast cancer, Paget's disease, which is not strictly speaking a cancer, and multiple myeloma. Many, if not all, of the cancer patients were actively undergoing chemotherapy, and the reason that they were placed on the bisphosphonates was because their cancer had spread to bone, and one of the strategies is to slow down bone breakdown by using these drugs to stabilize the bone. If the cancer can eat away the bone, it can destroy not just the bone, but it can also disrupt calcium levels in the bloodstream, leading to something called the hypercalcemia of malignancy, which can be very serious and kill you. So that's the rationale for using high-dose intravenous bisphosphonates. Other correlations with this condition, which is nasty enough, are having a tooth extracted or having some kind of surgical procedure on the gums. There were a couple of cases of osteonecrosis in people who were taking oral bisphosphonates for osteoporosis. You're not completely safe if that's your situation. However, I think a reasonable and rational way of looking at this is if you have osteoporosis, then you're safer from the standpoint of major life complications being on your bisphosphonate than off of it, because hip fractures kill you. Osteonecrosis might be painful, but it won't kill you, and it's rare in people taking these drugs orally. The second take-home lesson is if you have cancer, or for that matter, if you are just over 50, take care of your teeth. You know, floss, get the plaque removed, do the necessary to have healthy teeth and gums. We know that the vast majority of people who have a complication from the bisphosphonates had gum disease. They had bad teeth, they had gum disease, they had decay, they had to have a surgical procedure done on their mouth while they were on these drugs, and those were the ones who had poor healing. So I guess if you've got osteoporosis and you're taking Fosamax or Actonel, it would make sense to visit a dentist regularly and take care of your teeth, and also to avoid tooth extraction. Or maybe consider stopping the drug for several months before you have a tooth extraction. That's probably the most prudent way to go about it right now. Now, before I leave the topic, I just want to take a moment and tell you of my adventures on the web. I first went and asked the librarian at the hospital to pull articles for me. Candace Walker at Dominican Hospital is wonderful for doing that, and she will do it for the general public as well. And then I thought just for fun I would Google Fosamax and see what came up. I think I Googled Fosamax warning. I didn't get any Fosamax warnings. What I got was a page after page of lawyers who were phishing the internet for people who had taken Fosamax and might have a problem in their jaw. It's kind of ironic because I just finished reading a book by John Grisham called The Summons, in which one of the major characters, the so-called King of Torts, explains the modern legal drug tort system and how it works. Basically, nowadays, whenever there's a problem with a drug or a new complication like this one is discovered, hordes of lawyers all over the country go out and start sifting the population. They place ads in newsletters, ads on the internet, and they try to find anyone who has taken this drug and who has the problem or something plausibly like the problem. So I guess someone who has bad teeth who's taken Fosamax could probably get on this study. It would be the Defense Department's business to prove that the two were unrelated. And the more, as I understand the economics, the more names you have signed up, the more leverage you have. And they're not really going after a lawsuit. They never want this thing to go to court. What they're going after is a large settlement. So the more names you have on your list, the larger the settlement you'll get. And apparently the first settlement is always the largest. So there's kind of a race to the bar, so to speak, to sign up the most people. It's weird in the extreme. It's got a very Alice in Wonderland-like quality to it. And when I think of all of the people out there who are taking Fosamax and read this article in the newspaper and go, oh my God, I've endangered myself, my jaw is going to rot away, which is just such a terrible exaggeration of what the actual issue is and doesn't even apply to their group for the most part, all I can think of is what incredible harm that does. How distorting it is, how destructive it is to good healthcare policy, and also to self-confidence, both on the parts of the patient and the physician. We're the only country in the world that allows a lot of stupidities, but we really need to rethink this. This tort law thing has gotten extremely out of hand, particularly these large class action suits. It's really legalized extortion is what it is. It's no longer about justice. It's no longer about appropriate compensation to victims of negligence. This is a great cash cow that's being milked by the American Tort Association, who sends a lot of money to campaigns and therefore is untouchable legislatively without a large grassroots campaign. Maybe we need one. We're going to go now to Sue in Santa Cruz. Hello, Sue. You're on the air.
Hi, I have a question about about injectable bisphosphonates, which my doctor may be recommending, and mm-hmm. I see good things. I see that it not only increases bone density, but as you mentioned, reduces fractures. However, I have this one article. I don't know if you've heard of the Life Extension Foundation.
Oh, yes.
And I'd love to hear your fix on that, but I'll just ask a question.
About the
sustainability of reducing bone turnover, that it could impair repair of bones and cause increased bone mineralization and fragility, possibly.
It could theoretically absolutely do that. It just doesn't. And, you know, the question that everyone has is, you know, can we give this stuff indefinitely? Should we should we stop after 10 years, give people a drug holiday, and then, you know, come back after 5 years? What's the long-term strategy? Because we are, like we are with many pharmaceuticals, deeply interfering with a physiological process. And so it, whenever you interfere with a fundamental physiologic process, you're going to have downstream, long-term, unanticipated consequences, because we don't know everything. So the good news, I think, on the bisphosphonates is that they've been around so long now that there are cohorts of people who've been on the drug for 15 years. So we know that at least at a 15-year mark, if you that you're not seeing a sort of end point where the bones turn to powder and people have more fractures. Theoretically, that could happen, but it isn't happening. Again, we don't know everything, but what we do know seems to look like we're okay with this. My thought with the Fosamax and the Actinols of the world is if a person has osteoporosis, take it until your bone density is back up to normal or close to normal. Maybe after five to 10 years, go on a drug holiday. Do the weight-bearing exercise, do the calcium, maintain what you can, and then go back on it after you've lost some, because your bones will start to lose density again. You know, so let that happen and then start back on the drug if you have to. And I don't have very many patients, actually, who have to. Most people get back to their normal density and then actually go off the drug and, you know, kind of give up on it and say, well, I'm good now. We'll check again in 2 years. And that's where most of my folks are at. We're just monitoring their bone. But I don't have a problem keeping people on it because I think looking at what we know so far, it looks like it's okay to be on it for up to 15 years.
I couldn't take the oral, so I'm going to get injectable. Do you have any opinion about whether it should be a three-month thing or a... They have an annual injection now, and I'm just worried about what if you get flu-like structures, symptoms, which could be one side effect of something I often get with.
Yeah, well, most of the side effects, when you read about side effects, they're generally across the board. And so the flu-like syndrome that they discuss is largely with people getting it intravenously. That's where it's been seen. It isn't seen with the orals. With the injectable, I presume you're talking about an intramuscular injection. And so the drug has a hugely long half-life in the system when you give it that way. I'm not sure that anyone has the information you're asking for about whether it's better to go with a three-month or a one-year. But my inclination is to go with the shorter interval.
Uh-huh.
And the reason is we're treating osteoporosis here, right? You don't have cancer with bone mets.
Just osteopenia.
Okay, so osteopenia. So you don't actually even have a T-score of less than 2.5?
I do in my hip, but what I have is a vertebral fracture, and I have no osteopenia there, but...
Oh, okay. So you have something else going on, and there are a large number of people, by the way, who have something else going on, probably with the microstructure of their bones that affects the ability of the bone to maintain its integrity. In your situation, then, there are several courses. You can be go on the aggressive side or go on the light side. If you want to go on the light side, I would try... Why, by the way, can you not take the oral?
A stomach.
Okay, you're not going to necessarily escape the stomach stuff by taking it IM.
Mm.
Because the people who get it IV also can get erosive esophagitis.
Yeah. That's
yeah, so...
Can they take it back out of you if you have a problem once they've injected it?
Nope. Mm. Nope. What's wrong? What's wrong with the
parathyroid injection now that's supposed to be even better for... where I actually have the osteopenia in the femoral neck.
Yes, and you might want to think about doing it. That's Forteo.
Yeah.
And you might, you know, erosive, if you've had esophagitis, I consider that something of a contraindication to the use of the bisphosphonates, especially since we have two other alternatives. And, I mean, one good GI bleed will ruin your whole week.
Well, it could ruin a long time if it lasts for... 3 months or a year.
And not to mention the fact that if you're getting a lot of erosive esophagitis, that's a cancer ticket. And, you know, as you heal from that, there's the potential of developing esophageal cancer. So do we really want to go there at all? And what are we getting that we couldn't get in some other way?
It's whether the insurance will cover it. But
no. Stop right there. Do not live your life according to whether your insurance is going to pay for your drugs.
Well, if it's $1,000 a month.
You sit down at your typewriter or your word processor, and you start making phone calls, and you become an annoyance to them, and they'll give you what you want to shut you up. All right, you have a contraindication. You pull together the documentation that shows you have esophagitis, get copies of every doctor note that you've got that proves that. You look up, you Xerox the PDR, where it says very clearly that esophagitis is a contraindication to bisphosphonates, and you can go to any of the medical literature on bisphosphonates used intravenously, and you will find listed erosive esophagitis. It is a simple argument to make. It's a 3-point argument. I have this disease. Here's where it's a contraindication. Here's the evidence that that giving it intravenously is not going to protect me. You know, you need to pay for the Forteo.
Okay.
Okay. And what you have to do is you have to be a pain in the rear, and you'll get what you need, and it will require some effort on your part. And since you're the person who stands to benefit, I don't feel guilty at all asking you to make that effort.
No, I'll make the effort. I love your show. Thank you so much.
Be empowered. Don't let the insurance companies tell you how to live your life or tell you what medical care you need, because they'd just assume you were dead.
Well, my doctor said the esophagitis wouldn't be a problem with the intravenous, and I had done some looking up, and I couldn't find it. And, you know, I just can't take that chance.
I just found it. Let me see. You got a pencil?
Mm-hmm.
All right. This comes out of Journal of the American Cancer Society. This was published online 31 May 2005. I'll tell you what. Go talk to Candace Walker at Dominican Hospital and tell her that you want Migliorati, Migliorati. You want Migliorati's article.
R-A-T-I.
Rati, yeah, R-A-T-I. And good old Cesar Migliorati is the chief author of this article. She'll be able to pull it out for you. She just pulled them out for me yesterday. So that's one of the ones she printed out. It's in there. If you read carefully, it's in there.
Great. Monday through Friday at Dominican, huh?
Right. It's a great resource. We're very blessed in this community.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for your call. Good luck.
Thank you.
Go get them.
I will.
Bye-bye. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, and this is Ask Dr. Dawn. So if you'd like to do that or have a comment, maybe some advice for one of the other callers, chime on in. I love the community advice that we get on this program. Let's go now to Susie. Hello, Susie. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I have had carpal tunnel for many, many years, and last night I had a very dramatic change, and I'm wondering if this is a sign of something more serious or how you would interpret this. Basically, usually my hands go numb when I'm lying down at night, so I have hand braces.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last couple of nights, I noticed the middle finger on my right hand was getting almost painful. That's unusual, sort of a burning feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And last night, it became so painful that I couldn't sleep. It woke me 3 times and it was terribly burning. And I noticed that the pain also referred up above my elbow, above my right elbow, and so I was kind of massaging that, trying to do it. My braces were on and doing nothing. Finally, I tried many positions, and finally I switched my head. There's usually, I forget which side I prefer to have my head on if I'm lying on my stomach. So I switched to the other side, and the pain went away. So I slept for another 2 hours till I woke up. But when I woke up, my thumb, my middle, and my pointer finger were completely dead, numb, in a way that I've never experienced. And changing position, massaging them, nothing helped until I got vertical, sat up, and it took 8 minutes before the sensation came back. And that's just so dramatic. I mean,
okay. Now, a couple of questions. First of all, we're always on this program forced to respond to the diagnosis that's being given over the air. And before I go any further, some of what you've said raises a small suspicion in my mind about whether this is carpal tunnel or something masquerading as carpal tunnel.
Okay.
So, in general, the diagnosis of carpal tunnel is best made by an examination where you tap with a hammer over the inside of the wrist and you get a tingling electrical sensation that goes into the thumb, index first, and sometimes the ring finger, but avoids the pinky.
Mm-hmm.
And if a person, if I do that test and they're not you know, grossly positive, mm-hmm. I consider whether I wanted to get some confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
There are two other conditions that can mimic carpal tunnel enough, and if you're in a hurry and you're getting kind of a, oh, that sounds like carpal tunnel here, try these wrist splints sort of diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
then you might have one of these.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one of them could be disc disease or arthritis in the neck, pinching the nerve, and the other could be something called thoracic outlet syndrome, which is a condition where either because of tight muscles in the neck or because of an extra bone in the neck, the nerves, as they come out, get strummed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fairly common condition and often missed because it's a little bit subtle to test for.
Mm-hmm.
But if you haven't been checked for thoracic outlet, all doctors know the testing. They just may not think to do it.
Okay.
So it would be worth thinking about that, because
okay.
What I'm basing that on is the moving your head thing.
Yes, exactly.
By the way, stomach sleeping is a bad idea if you have any kind of neurological symptoms in your hands or numbness or tingling or any neck pathology.
Oh, really?
It's really better to sleep either fully on your side or on your back with a pillow under your knees than you know, on your stomach, because to avoid suffocation, you basically have to crank your head way the heck over.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a good sleeping position.
Mm-hmm.
So people with headaches and neck pain, I really try to break them of that.
Okay.
And any chiropractor or body worker will tell you that if you've got mild carpal tunnel and tight neck muscles,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have more severe carpal tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And often conservative management for carpal tunnel in either acupuncture or body work
mm-hmm.
involves going centrally and fixing the neck
mm-hmm.
and then working your way out to the carpal tunnel.
Being
said, some people have carpal tunnel because they have a tight anatomic structure in their hand, and many people have it because they overuse their hands at work or they use a poor position.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole series of exercises and stretches and things
mm-hmm.
that can help. But ultimately, if it is carpal tunnel, and you can get that confirmed by neurologic, I'd say get a neurologic consult.
I have had two nerve conduction studies,
sure.
And they only show those. It's been getting much worse, and the second nerve conduction study didn't show any worsening.
Mm-hmm. But symptomatically, you've got worse.
Symptomatically, I'm much worse.
You know, you need to think about the surgery.
I think you have something on the neck thing, because my neck has been very weird and painful since January. Had many different approaches to it. I should also say that yesterday I got acupuncture directly for the carpal tunnel,
mm-hmm.
and then it got so much worse last night. So,
well, in acupuncture terms, if you get worse after an acupuncture treatment, that's good.
Okay.
Because it usually means in a day or two after that, you're going to be much better.
Oh, well, okay.
So it could be that this is the beginning of improvement.
Okay.
But on the other hand, if it doesn't pan out that way...
Uh-huh.
Yes, have the neck looked at and see if there might be some coexisting pathology there.
Okay.
Good luck.
Sounds good. Thank you for the ideas.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Ask Dr. Dawn, and I hope you're enjoying the program. I want to just remind you that Ask Dr. Dawn is made possible by a grant from John F. Kennedy's University's Graduate School of Professional Psychology in Campbell, offering a master's degree in counseling psychology designed for busy adults. Information at 800-868-2359. Ask Dr. Dawn is also made possible by a grant from Well Within Spa. Well Within offers massage therapy, face and body care, and private spa rooms overlooking a Japanese garden in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is available at 458-WELL and online at wellwithinspa.com. We're going now to Debbie in Santa Cruz. Hello, Debbie. You're on the air.
Hi. I called you a little over a year ago and... concurred with your recommendation to go ahead and get on Fosamax because
mm-hmm.
I was osteopenic.
Yes.
Osteopenia and had a long history in the family of osteoporosis. And after being on 35 milligrams for the year, I had a test done and had lost 6% in my hip and now was in osteoporosis.
Mm-hmm.
However, I gained 4% in my spine. I was very concerned about that. So I went to the doctor and they said, well, we'll double your dose. So they've doubled me up to 70 milligrams. And then I went and had a hair analysis done, and it turns out that I have a mineral toxicity of copper. And when I
researched... Do you dye your hair?
Pardon me?
Do you dye your hair?
No.
Okay.
So, well, I mean, when I was younger, I did.
Well, this hair that they're testing, has it been chemically processed?
No.
Okay.
And so I'm wondering where copper might have come from, and I did find out that copper can inhibit the absorption of calcium. On the same test, my calcium levels were off the chart. Couldn't even be measured.
No, wait. On the hair test?
On the hair test, yeah.
Okay.
So a lot of my minerals were normal, but some of them were a little low, so I'm dealing with that. But the one I'm concerned about is the copper toxicity, and I'm doing a protocol for that. But I'm also concerned about the high level of calcium in my bloodstream, and I'm wondering if I continue to do massive amounts of calcium and do all the stuff that I've always done to, you know, encourage bone growth. If I'm actually just pumping calcium in by system, it's not getting absorbed by the bone and creating calcium deposits elsewhere.
Okay, well, that's a compound question and a half.
Yeah.
Let me see if I can pull apart the hairs there. First of all, calcium in the blood is pretty highly regulated. If it isn't, we die. And we have two hormones. We have parathyroid hormone and calcitonin, which have another teeter-totter push-pull sort of relationship, where they take calcium out of the bone or they put it in the bone. The bone is the major storage depot for calcium. If you have high levels of parathyroid hormone, you can have you can pull more calcium out of the bone than you need, and then you'll have calcium in the bloodstream at abnormal levels, and that's a clue.
Mm-hmm.
So this is blood testing that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. I have low TSH.
Okay, well, that's a different issue. Let's try not to add that.
Okay.
Thank you for the information, but I think I want to try to stay on the track here. I don't think, you mentioned you were on a protocol. In general, I view hair analysis with skepticism because its reproducibility from lab to lab has been shown to be poor. That means there's good labs and bad labs. The other reason is because products that have been applied to the surface of the hair that might be present in your water, that might be present in, if you had copper pipes in your house, for example, you could have a lot of copper in your hair and it would have nothing whatsoever to do with copper in your bloodstream. And so I generally do actual levels, blood levels. I view the hair thing as a screening.
Mm-hmm.
But then I check to make, particularly with hair analysis, I check to make sure that it actually reflected in total body levels. And that's not a hard thing to do. There is a copper storage disease that people can have where they lack an enzyme to get rid of copper. And I believe it's called Wilson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And this condition is not an uncommon variation. You could have it, and that, you know, in other words, the hair stuff could be real. You really need serum confirmation before you start building too elaborate a structure on this. And the same thing's true of calcium, in that a lot of products, if you look at the ingredients on a shampoo or hair conditioners, you'll see a whole lot of chemical salts, and some of them do use calcium. So it's kind of like, okay, calcium in the hair, what does that mean physiologically? And I'm not sure, so checking calcium levels in the serum before you assume there's an issue. Maybe throw in a parathyroid hormone level while you're at it. And as far as the, now I'll bring in that TSH that you mentioned. The TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, if it's below about 0.5, could indicate an overactive thyroid, not an underactive thyroid. So when you say it's low, it would, if it is, you know, below normal, then you are concerned about the presence of an overactive thyroid.
Well, perhaps it was high then, because they did say I have hypothyroid.
See, it is confusing, isn't it? It's always the inverse. Okay, so what is, you know, going back to the very beginning, the issue really is that you've had bone loss at the hip while you were taking a drug to prevent bone loss at
the hip.
Exactly. So at this point, rather than doubling your dose of Fosamax, I would be inclined to check your vitamin D levels and make sure those are adequate.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't matter how much Fosamax I give you if you aren't if you aren't absorbing the calcium from your gut, and we don't know that you are.
I spend a couple hours a day in the sun whenever it's out.
That's nice, but from October to March in this area, you won't make any vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
You can stay in the sun all day. The photons aren't strong enough for you to make vitamin D. Little known fact. So you could have low levels, and that could be a factor in why you've lost bone progressively despite being on an appropriate drug. So you need to check that one out. And then the last thing I would say is, you know, you could consider one of the other two agents. I mean, you essentially have arguably a treatment failure. So it's like, okay, if you can't find any reason for the treatment failure, like a hormonal abnormality that could account for it, then why, and by the way, hypothyroidism can sometimes promote osteoporosis.
Exactly.
So it's like you fix the hormones. If the hormones are, once the hormones are stabilized, you know, maybe you use it, if you're still having bone loss, maybe use a different drug.
Mm-hmm. I read in an article about the other drug you mentioned earlier.
Forteo, and there's also Evista. So there are three drug categories.
Well, there's one, I think it began with an A, was one you just mentioned a minute ago, and it was supposed to, in the recent research show, they said that it helped prevent breast cancer.
That's Evista.
Evista, okay.
It's Raloxa something or other, but I don't remember the actual name. I can look it up. Anyway, go ahead. So,
I was wondering if I should perhaps think about, I'm on my last dose of this last...
Well, I'm not, you know, I can only tell you that I think, speaking as a physician, mm-hmm. when I've had this situation in my practice, it's my routine practice to switch to a different drug group rather than just increase the dose of the drug they were on.
Got it.
And I think that's a rational approach.
Mm-hmm.
We have lots of differences in our physiologies. I mean, the more we study it, the more we realize how wrong we've been with our one-size-fits-all sort of approach.
Exactly. And I heard the show a couple of weeks ago, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. So,
it is raloxifene, by the way, Evista. I was right about that.
It is raloxifene?
Raloxifene, yeah.
Okay. So I was basically calling to see if I should make a doctor appointment and consider getting the other drug rather than doubling this dose of Fosamax.
In general terms, yeah, I think that's a really good idea. And I think since you've brought up these issues with the hair analysis, while you're in there, get checked out for that just to make sure there isn't some kind of congenital copper storage deficiency or something there. There's this thing called ceruloplasmin. It's a protein. It's supposed to grab copper and let you excrete it. And if you don't make it or you don't make enough of it, you will accumulate copper in your body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's worth chasing it. But hair analysis is like, it's the smoke alarm. Okay, your smoke alarm in your kitchen goes off. There may or may not be a fire. You tend to look around and, you know, look around and investigate.
Sure.
You don't necessarily start call the fire department based on the smoke alarm going off. Okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We're going now to Leslie in Santa Cruz. Hello, Leslie, and welcome to the program.
Hi. I had a question about an ear infection. A week ago Friday, my ear closed up, and I went into urgent care, and they couldn't figure it out for whatever reasons, and referred me to an ear specialist.
Oh, boy.
Who did diagnose it as a ear infection. And I've been on an antibiotic since Tuesday, Bacoderm, I believe, something of that sort is the name of it.
Is it an antibiotic drop that you put in your ears?
No, it's antibiotic pills.
Hmm. All right. Well, I'm sure that's not ringing a bell for me name-wise, but go ahead.
And at any rate, the ear infection is absolutely no better. And, you know, I was told to call back on Monday if it's not better, and mm-hmm. it's not. I can't hear in the ear. My equilibrium is off. It's driving me nuts.
Are you having pain?
A little bit, but not a great deal.
Okay. So what you've got is you've got no impaired hearing and impaired balance on one side.
On one side, my left side.
Do you know if your eardrum was red when the doctor looked in it?
I was told, actually, in urgent care that both of my eardrums looked wonderfully gray and healthy.
All right. Doesn't surprise me one bit. So you went to an ear, nose, and throat doctor?
Yes.
And were diagnosed with a middle ear infection.
Mm-hmm.
I find that a little confusing because when people have a middle ear infection, they almost always have a red eardrum. So I'm just, I wasn't there. I haven't looked in your ears. I can't second guess anybody except to say that there may be a missing piece of information here that explains why the specialist puts you on antibiotics that you can't share with me because you don't know it.
I don't know it.
But the symptoms you're describing sound more like fluid than an actual bacterial infection.
I was told there is fluid in there.
Mm-hmm. And that happens very commonly this time of year because our noses run more.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're lying on, let's say you're lying on your left side at night and your nose is running,
mm-hmm.
and you swallow in your sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you do that, you open up the eustachian tube. It opens and closes when you swallow. And the eustachian tube may be sitting at the bottom of a pool of mucus, just like a that's accumulated because you're lying on that side. And so you've got this mucus in your nose. The hole opens up at the bottom just like a drain in a sink opening up. And during your swallow, you actually suck or reflux a little bit of fluid into the ear, into that passageway. And
yeah.
it continues to head downhill until it fetches up against your eardrum, which is the lowest portion. So your left eardrum is the lowest part of your of the opening. It's the bottom of the hole.
Yeah.
Now, after three or four swallows, a couple of, you know, say, couple of hours lying on that side, you may accumulate enough gooey fluid behind the eardrum to impair the movement of the eardrum.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you sit up and go about your business and your mucus dries up a little bit, what's left in the hole, that the drainage tube that got it down there, dries up and forms a kind of gooey plug.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you can't move air or fluid in or out of that passageway. And the typical symptoms of that are a little disequilibrium and a lot of muffling. And sometimes pain when you go, let's say you go from Ben Lomond down to the coast,
mm-hmm.
in the altitude change, you might get an earache or your ears might pop or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, those symptoms can persist for weeks, and occasionally that fluid will become infected, and antibiotics can be useful. But most of the time, what's needed is more of a effort to thin the mucus so that gravity flows out from behind your eardrum while you're upright during the days.
Okay, nothing is flowing out at all. Mm-hmm. My ear slowly closed up a week ago Friday.
Yes, ma'am.
It opened Saturday morning momentarily, and a bunch of fluid drained out,
mm-hmm.
closed right back up. And then on Sunday, I finally decided to go into urgent care. And the one thing I just remembered, one of the reasons they couldn't figure out what it was they saw, as they looked down the tube, they saw something that they wrote on my referral slip as a mass, which disturbed me. And they didn't know what the mass was.
Okay.
In the canal.
All right. Well, I think I probably know what the mass was in the canal. Anyone who's grown up near the Pacific Ocean or spent any time in the Pacific Ocean underwater,
yeah.
gets cold Pacific Ocean water in their ear.
Yeah.
And we tend in this area to form these little bony knobs in our ear canals, in our external canals. If the doctor who was looking in there came from another part of the country, they might never have seen one before. They're pretty common on the ground around here. You could just kind of look around them. They're bony nodules that form as a reaction to cold water.
Inside the ear.
Yes, indeed.
Wow.
And your ear, nose, and throat doctor locally sees them constantly and views them as a normal variant and probably didn't even think to mention it to you.
No, she didn't.
Because she's used to having to look around those things all the time.
And I thought the mass had to do with the infection.
No, the word mass is a freak-out word, isn't it?
It is. It's a freak-out word.
Yeah. Huge is another word I try to avoid in medicine. People don't like to hear that anything they have is huge.
Well, now, I'm supposed to get on an airplane Thursday to go to Hawaii.
Oh, well, the plot thickens.
The plot thickens.
But we want the mucus to thin. So here's some suggestions for you.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Number one, unless you have high blood pressure.
I do.
Okay. Then you can't do this. You can't do number one. I'll put number one out there anyway, though.
Mm-hmm.
Number one is an hour before you get on the plane, you actually squirt nasal decongestant in your nose. Good old neosinephrine.
I do it anyway, just because I have to.
You do it every day?
No, I do it just for flying
because I have
a terrible time getting my ears.
Right. You've got bad anatomy to start with, and now you've got a mucus plug in there and
you can't
get it out. So here's number two. Go down to the store and buy guaifenesin. There's a trade name version of it, Mucinex. It's a company name, Mucinex. Get the one without decongestant because of your hypertension and start taking that. That's step two.
Mucinex.
Right. It's a 12-hour drug. Just keep taking it straight through between now and the time you get off.
Okay.
Number three, steam. You can either do a little steam, a little facial sauna. If you've got one of those old facial sauna machines, you can boil water in a bowl and make a tent with a towel. You can do a 10-minute steamy shower twice a day. But you're going to steam your face. You breathe that steam in through your nose, suck, 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 suck. And then after you breathe it in the steam for a few minutes, you yawn, you swallow, then you breathe some more, then you yawn and you swallow. And you're trying to shake your eustachian tube. One chiropractor told me, I haven't seen independent confirmation on this, grab the ear on the outside and make circular motions with it. What the heck? Do that too. Can't hurt. And the idea is you're trying to shake out the goo.
Okay.
Get the plug, get the passageway open so that when the glue hardens off in the airplane, you've still got a passageway.
Yeah.
And do that aggressively for the next few days. And good luck to you on the flight.
Okay. All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For the call. Nice practical advice for airplane travelers. And I didn't mention, but I should have, take an aspirin before you get on an airplane if you're not planning to do jumping jacks in the hallways. Many people die of pulmonary embolism as a result of blood clots forming in their legs on airplanes. There's probably about 40 deaths a year internationally attributable to that. I don't know what the nationwide figures are. That is undoubtedly a low estimate because those are just the people who drop dead getting off the airplane. Many people will suffer that clot traveling to the lung in the day subsequent to the air flight and therefore never be identified within the system and be counted. So take an aspirin. It's not a big deal. Unless you've got ulcers or for some other reason can't tolerate aspirin, it's a good idea. I also recommend support hose if you're over the age of 40 because letting the legs expand on the airplane is not good and does promote the development of these blood clots. Let's go now to Dorothy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Dorothy, and thank you for waiting.
You're welcome. I have a question about something that happened with my 28-year-old daughter a few weeks ago. She had extreme chest pain, and by the time I heard about it and went over to her and her husband's home, it was after 9, and the urgent care stuff was closed, and it was too expensive for the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So the next morning, she was still in extreme pain, also including down her left arm. We went to urgent care, and it wasn't heart stuff, but they gave this very ambiguous diagnosis, and it included things like acid reflux, anxiety, chest pain, chest muscle, spasm going behind the heart. And it was just very, very confusing. And during the doctor's visit, my daughter said, "Oh, I've had these pains all my life," which was news to me and her father. But this was the most extreme case. And I'm trying to encourage her to follow up, and she's kind of reluctant to do that. And
I wonder, was she eating when this happened?
No, she was actually taking a test, a hard anatomy test.
She was in the middle of taking her anatomy test
exactly.
When this hit? Okay.
And she does have anxiety issues. She does get anxiety attacks, but this news of her having had these pains, although not this severe all her life, do you have any ideas?
Well, the all my life part does definitely change the approach to this because there used to be a sign, I drove by it every day on my way home from UCLA, and it said, "If you lived here, you'd be home by now." Of course, you're sitting in bumper-to-bumper traffic,
right.
And it always read as a nya, 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 nya. But it, realistically, as a rule of thumb, if it was going to kill you, you'd be dead by now. Because if you've had it all your life, that completely changes. That completely changes the approach, because whatever it is, it's not. It, you know, for one thing, it's not new, so it can't be a sudden development of, let's say, a clot in a small area of coronary plaque, which, you know, they had 21-year-olds in Vietnam that had plaque in their coronaries. So just because you're 28 doesn't prove that you couldn't have a heart attack. It's extremely rare, but we know it can happen.
Exactly.
So that's being said, it's extremely rare. So how hard are you going to chase it if you've got another explanation? The other thing that crosses my mind, if she's had it all her life, would be I would think about checking for mitral valve prolapse. Common problem. often causes rather severe chest pain in women under anxiety situations.
Uh-huh.
Often gets written off as panic attacks. And in a manner of speaking, it's a physiological expression of too much adrenaline. So it is kind of a panic attacky sort of thing. But it's caused by stretching of the heart valve because the blood pressure goes up because of the adrenaline. And so this heart valve is loose and it bulges backwards. And when it bulges backwards hard, it hurts. The esophagus can cause pain because the nerves run right next to the heart. It's clinically indistinguishable from chest pain, from cardiac chest pain. And it can radiate to the left arm and it can radiate to the left jaw.
And can it last for hours?
It can.
Okay.
And it would be top of the list statistically because of her age. Now, nothing is 100% in medicine. You always, you know, if you make an always statement, someone's going to prove you wrong. But if your daughter has had this for a long time and this was just a worse version, she might consider trying to get her insurance to pay for an echocardiogram.
They did an echocardiogram and the EKG and X-ray.
So she doesn't have, and they did this in the urgent care?
They did.
Wow, I didn't know that you could get an echo at an urgent care that quickly. That's cool.
Maybe there wasn't an echo.
You need to make sure. Okay. An echocardiogram is usually done at the hospital or at a freestanding radiologic facility. And to my knowledge, none of the urgent cares locally have an echo machine or the ability to read an echo.
Okay.
So anyway, that being said, I think an echocardiogram to look for any cardiac structural abnormality, given that it's a young woman and she's had this on and off forever and she's got a panicky type flavor to her reaction to stress, which is not a character weakness, it's just an observation. That's how she's what they used to call high strung. You know, that's how she's set up.
Yeah.
So that's the wiring diagram. You got to deal with it. Now, if it's esophageal, what I often do in that circumstance is I give someone a local anesthetic in their esophagus. So I have them drink lidocaine mixed with some antacid. And basically, I relax the muscle. I put a muscle relaxant in there, I put a numbing agent in there, and I put an antacid in there. And in about 15 minutes, if the chest pain has reduced by at least 20%, then I'm pretty confident that I'm dealing with a non-cardiac pain.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was done in the emergency,
in the urgent care,
but that would have been a nice thing to have done and could be done anytime she has this pain.
Well, that's really my question. I think we're feeling comfortable that it's not cardiac at this point, but if it happened again, I was wondering, I generally get called for advice.
Buy her a big bottle of Maalox.
Okay.
And have her, in fact, buy her three small bottles of Maalox and have her keep one in the car, one at her desk, and one in her purse. And then the minute she gets this, she chugs about a quarter cup of Maalox.
Okay.
And she sees if it changes how it usually behaves.
Okay.
That's your little home biopsy kit for it being esophageal. And if you get a big shift, 20% or more improvement in pain with the antacid, then you chase the esophagus, you chase the GI.
Okay.
Okay?
Well, thank you so much.
I would still try to get the echo, though.
I'll pass that on.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Dr. Dawn Motika, and you're listening to Ask Dr. Dawn. We have time for Barbara in Watsonville. Hello, Barbara. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much. I have a girlfriend who wakes up at night with itching palms and soles of her feet. And so she wakes up and starts scratching, and she told me that she's even created sores on occasion with that.
So she wakes up with itching on the soles of her feet, did you say?
And on the palms of her hand.
And not on the backs of her hands or the tops of her feet?
No, the palms.
Interesting, okay. And she's managed to draw blood, you said?
That's what she told me.
Yikes, yeah. Okay.
Yikes.
Well, that have you seen these palms and feet?
No, I haven't. Okay. I will see her in a few days, but I haven't as yet.
So to arm you for, you know, trying to help her, first thing that comes to mind is fungus. Is there a fungus among us? And because it's also affecting the palms, the other one, which is on the list, if it's just the feet, which is a reaction to some of the materials, the aniline dyes and the leather hardeners and things that are used in shoes. There's a lot of potential allergens in shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it were just her feet, I'd be thinking, you know, could it be a shoe reaction? But if it's also the palms,
mm-hmm.
it's sort of an interesting connection. Fungus is certainly a possibility, and fungal appearance would be thickening of the skin, maybe a white, flaky quality, or conversely, a sort of poison oaky kind of rash. Is this a condition she's had for a long time?
I think it's been fairly chronic for the last 6 months to a year.
And how old is she?
58.
Okay, so comparatively young.
Now, she does have, she did, at one point she told me she had a positive diagnosis of lupus, but then apparently that went away, or at least the test showed negative. And then her family does have polymyositis and some other autoimmune things in it.
Yeah, well, there is an entity called dermatomyositis, which is a possibility. And I think psoriasis would also be on the list. So the all kind of autoimmune, non-specific diagnoses probably needs a dermatology visit.
Mm-hmm.
And those are not dermatologists.
I think she's been, and she says they're all just completely puzzled,
baffled. Well, then I guess you move to ways to prevent itching or reduce itching.
Yeah.
And there's topical anti-itch creams. One called Zonalon, Zonalon.
Okay.
I found pretty helpful.
Uh-huh.
You could also use Lidoderm patches, which might penetrate well. Be kind of expensive, but I guess in the middle of the night when your feet are itching like crazy, the idea of blowing $3 or $4 a night to sleep doesn't sound so bad.
What was the name of the patch again?
Lidoderm, L-I-D-O.
Okay.
And those would be two things to think about trying.
Uh-huh. Great. And then as long as we're on feet, can I ask you another quick question?
Uh-huh.
My husband just bought some fairly fancy insoles. He's got cauda equina and feet problems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there any rule of thumb about, he was told to wear them like half an hour a day for a while and then move up a little bit and so forth, but is there any rule of thumb about when you just throw in the towel and say these aren't going to work?
These are custom orthotics or off the shelf?
No, these are off the shelf.
Well, okay. Probably time to get a set of custom. If you've tried, to wear them in half an hour, your feet hurt, and you do that several days in a row and your feet are not adapting to it, it's probably not for you. Your husband has, because of his congenital condition there, a completely non-standard foot.
Mm-hmm.
It's a non-standard issue. It's a custom foot.
Right.
And so the stuff that's built, to fit the greatest number of feet so that it's, general purpose, it's not going to fit him.
Uh-huh.
And so at least on the quad equina side, he needs, he needs a real custom job orthotic. Maybe
okay.
You can get them for half price if you only do one foot.
Huh.
But
is that what you do sometimes?
Well, I don't see why not. If the other foot's standard issue, just get one orthotic.
Yeah.
And take in the one that you're going to be using on the good foot, the foot that's standard issue.
Well, they both hurt, actually.
Okay. Well, you'll have to, it's the difference between $200 and $400, so you might want to just see if you can find somebody who will do one for you.
Huh.
And, go for the worst foot first.
Yeah.
And at least that way you validate the concept.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Ask Dr. Dawn, and let's see, we have about 3 minutes left to go. I think I'm going to invite our last caller to go ahead and call back next week or stay on the line if you'd like instead, and I'll pick up your call after the program is over. But I want to do justice to your question and don't think I can do that in such a comparatively brief period of time. So I have something to tell you about, which I found fascinating and which I do intend to post on the website, askdrdawn.com. And let me just mention about the website. We do keep things posted. The interviews are up there under interviews in the archives. Links and sometimes tables that I've referred to will be posted. This one actually comes from the Life Extension Foundation's journal, which I got for a couple of years. On Life Extension, I'll say that they've got really good information, which they use in a shamelessly commercial way. Their facts are good, but I think their underlying basic premise may be flawed. So they sell nutrients, and boy, do they sell nutrients. They really have a sales pitch. clustered between the sales pitches for the nutrients. Before that is a really nice scientific digested article presented very flashy marketing style, not scientific style, with really good references, which I've checked out repeatedly and found to be quite valid to support every point that they make. So from a scientific standpoint, it looks a little distasteful, but the data is there. So, and I guess if you want to buy their vitamins, go ahead and buy their vitamins. But I think you're better off eating the foods. So let's talk x-rays, okay? Radiation dose comparison. And we're talking about how long it takes you to get an equivalent dose from natural background radiation. In other words, natural background radiation is about 3 mSv. I'm not even sure what SV stands for. And if you get a chest x-ray, it's going to take 2.5 days to get that much radiation just walking around on the planet. This is not a big deal. If you get a skull x-ray, it's the equivalent of 4 chest x-rays, and that means 8 days, a little over a week's worth of background radiation. These are not big-ticket items in the cancer lottery here. On the other hand, if you have a lumbar spine x-ray, we're starting to get into some significant radiation doses to penetrate all of that fat and muscle. It's 158 days, about a half a year of background radiation. That's starting to sound like it might mean something. If you have a CT scan of your head, that's 243 days of background radiation. You want to really need that CT. That's almost an extra year of radiation in your life. If you have a CT scan of your abdomen, that's 500 chest x-rays. That's almost 3.3 years of background radiation to be equivalent to 1 abdominal CT. Now, if you've got an intra-abdominal cancer, or you've got a bleed, or you've got something that's major and life-threatening, then an abdominal CT is what you need, and take your hit on the background radiation. But the idea that getting, let's say, a total body CT scan hunting for diseases, okay, so you've bumped your background radiation by 3.5 years. Let's say you do that yearly for 10 years, 30 years of background radiation to find a disease that you may or may not have. That's being heavily promoted right now to the public, and that is not a sensible strategy. So to say again, if you will go to the website in a week or so, I'll have this radiation dose comparison posted and you'll be able to look at it. This has been a really nice show, and I hope that everyone will continue to listen here to Ask Dr. Dawn. As I think about doing this program and think about my weeks, this is one of the joyful moments in my week, being part of the community, being here on the radio. I truly enjoy it, and I hope you enjoy listening to the program even half as much as I enjoy doing it. This is Dr. Dawn Motyka saying so long. And stay healthy.